Hello everyone, my name's Tom Whittaker and this is my podcast, Talking with the Hippies. And today, I've just got back from a trip to Wales with my friend John, who throughout the 70s, you were known as Blue, not John.
To certain people.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So it was kind of an alias.
Really. It was an alias name, one of them that I used.
So it's been quite a trip for you, John, up to Wales. I didn't realise it was going to be like it's been. It's like almost there are people up there that we knew we were going to see that you were familiar with and friends with even up to and through Operation Julie. And so I just wondered how you're feeling now you've kind of been through all that. I know at times I detected you were a bit nervous about some of it, but you seem to have come through okay. Am I reading you right?
Yeah, just a little apprehensive, and it did bring up quite a lot for me. I wasn't quite sure what it was going to bring up, but once you know, driving with you, and it was really a really enjoyable journey, and I was open and kind of looking towards. Seeing smiles again and seeing Mary and possibly, you know, people in the audience that was around the time that I knew from Clan Dubrovi and Tregaron and that whole area. From, you know, sort of 75 to 77.
Can I just ask you, John, how did you get involved in that whole scene? Was that, did you just move there or what happened?
I arrived back in the country in 75.
Yeah.
Okay. I'd returned from, I have to say, somewhere. I returned to Leicester. Okay. Because while I was away, I'd become a dad.
Right.
I'd become a father.
Okay.
I heard there was going to be a dad, contacted Robbie, who was the mother, mother-to-be, and just said, look, you know, I didn't really know. It was kind of, we'd only spent a very short time together while I was there. So I'm hearing that was kind of a shock. And I said, well, look, you know, I'm not planning on coming back. Let's keep in touch and let me know, I'll keep in touch with you. You let me know how you're doing and how I can, you know, support you and in some way or another. Thinking, well, what's this, you know? And so I did. So the whole thing happened. And then basically my daughter was born while I was in California. And then it was 6 months before I got back to Leicester. So my daughter was 6 months old before I actually held her in my arms and seen her.
Why did you decide to go and live in Wales, John?
Because I was a dad, and I didn't want to live in Leicester with my daughter and a mother.
And you did you know that area where you went ended up living? Because you ended up living in Landry Brevin.
Yeah. Right? Well, I knew. I wanted to get out of Leicester or get my daughter and her mum and me out of Leicester. I didn't want to live in Leicester where we were. I had a friend who had a brother in Clan Dewi Brevi. And her name was Roma. And it was a dear friend of mine from Marbella that I knew in Marbella. But she was from Leicester. So that's a whole story in itself.
So that's how you... So you homed in on Clan Dewi Brevi.
Yeah, through Roma's brother, O'Brien, who actually ended up, and he was living beside Smiles.
Okay. Oh, yeah, okay.
Which was brilliant.
Okay, let me just... No, that's good. Let me just say what we got up to this weekend, just to fill people in, was we went to Clan Dewi Brevi because I've developed a little bit of an interest in this whole Operation Julie thing. It's a fascinating story. And we went to Clan Dewi Brevi and we took a look at the houses that were involved in the kind of, you know, all the stuff that was happening. And we also went and visited the pub, which also features strongly in quite a few of the books have already been written. And the house that you lived in, John, by chance, was next door, smack next door, joined on to Smiles's house.
That's correct.
And for anyone who's not familiar with this story, Smiles really has turned out to be the central character, really, in this drama, Operation Julie drama. Just to fill everyone in on why we went up there. Mm-hmm. We went up there to look at Landrieu Bevery, but we also went up there because there was a performance being put on at the Aberystwyth Arts Centre of a musical directed by a lady called Gaynor Stiles. And do you know, I've never been to a musical before, and I did try and watch Tommy on telly when I was younger, and I couldn't make it through. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was a great evening, John, I thought. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I thought it was a brilliant cast, brilliantly done. I'd been involved with theatre myself in the past, and I know how much it takes to put something remotely like that. And I thought it was absolutely brilliant in every aspect, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. Yeah.
Yeah, it was excellent, and afterwards, of course, it was followed up by a sort of question and answers with a few of the people that have been involved in the story, plus Gaynor, who put this musical together, and we'll go into that as well later. That was a fascinating part of the evening as well. But one thing, getting back to Landrieu Bevery now, John, because you became a part of the story because of mainly because of the undercover cop.
Stephen Bentley.
Yeah, the undercover cop, Stephen Bentley. I think you might have been one of the first people that he came across when he got there with his mate as undercover cops. Can you remember that?
Yeah, I can, yeah, really clearly and distinctly. We were in the new inn, and I was with a guy called Mac, and he was a friend of Buzz and Smiles that lived next door, and their wives. And Buzz's wife at the time was pregnant, so she was expecting, and Smiles had two daughters. One, the youngest, was the same age as my daughter, pretty much. They were both about the same age. And Mac was a part of the furniture, if you like. He was around Landrieu Bevery. He was very good with horses, and it was good crack. So him and I was having a drink, and these guys came in, Steve and Ginger, also known as, well, his name was Eric. I called him Ginger because he was a ginger nut. He had ginger hair, and I called him Ginger, and I guess other people did from there on, you know. Anyway, yeah, so we had a drink, and then basically I invited them back to my place, which was called Bridge End, which was beside Buzz and Smiles' place. We were neighbours, and I put on some records, and we were shooting a rhubarb, and they told me, you know, obviously, you know, you're asking why, what you're about, who you, you know, what you're doing in these neck of the woods, blah blah blah. And so I, you know, kind of interesting guys. It's not in Wales, you don't have visitors coming to the New Inn or Landrieu Bevery that often. You know, it's not like people just drop into Landrieu Bevery. You know, there's a reason. Anyway, they came back to my place. Tom, do you want to ask me? You know what I mean?
Yeah. So that's how it all started, and from that, a relationship developed between those guys and the sort of scene in Landrieu Bevery.
Yeah, yeah.
And they became part of the scene.
That's when they first arrived, and they met Smiles and Buzz afterwards.
Yeah.
But that was their first.
You were the first port of call, but you also played a big part in that, because you got Steve wrote a book called Undercover, which was how I got involved in this whole story, really, when I read it. And you've got quite a big part in that book, and he got really friendly with you, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. And in that book, incidentally, only the other day, I thought, wait a minute, you know, my name is mentioned over 120 odd times. You know, I think it was 130, but you know, it was like, that's a lot of times to be mentioned in a book. And there was a chapter dedicated to this guy Blue, which was me. So prior to that, all the other books and whatever, I wasn't that interested. When I got out of what I got out of Landieu Brevi after the bust, and they bust my door down and all that rest, all that happened, and I got out and left. But straight off that night, it was obvious that these guys were not who they said they were.
Yeah, they told you they were van dealers, didn't they?
Yeah, it was BS, you know, it's bullshit. And to me, it was obvious. It was kind of wasn't. I said to Mac when Mac was leaving, I said, keep an eye on these guys. You know, I said that to him.
So they were posing as van dealers, and you knew.
Well, they were posing as a few things. Two stories. One, they bought and sold cars and vans and stuff, you know, so they're car dealers, you know, which didn't kind of wash really. Why would you come to Wales to... And the other story was basically that Ginger, apparently his brother had got, you know, was on the run, jumped bail or something. And okay. He was on the run from the cops because he jumped bail for some minor misdemeanor or whatever. But, you know.
And they were looking for him.
They were looking for him. And, okay,
fair enough. That sounds like a good story.
Sounds like a good story. But it was just the way it came over didn't sound genuine, I suppose, really. I don't know. You ask questions around it, I'd be like, oh, okay, well, you know, that shouldn't be difficult to find in Wales.
I mean, do you think, you know, when we were watching that musical and the cops in that musical came across as really stupid, now, do you think that was a fair representation?
Not to the extent of the musical, no. They really made them look like a pair of real idiots. And they weren't that idiotic. Nobody could be. You know, it's a movie, well, it's a musical, and, you know, they were written into it. But to be honest, it wasn't, you know, a true indication of Steve or Ginger as being completely out to lunch, if
did,
you like.
Did they get it right that Ginger was easily more suspect than Steve.
Steve was more open, kind of friendly, kind of amenable, more relaxed than Ginger was. Ginger was definitely, you know, he's hiding something, or he's up, a bit uptight, is the expression. So he was a bit more serious. And a little bit not comfortable. He wasn't playing himself type thing. It was something that didn't quite fit. So just to go back a little bit, because Robbie, I mean, to my partner, and, you know, without getting into the ins and outs, she's a pretty smart cookie in a way of sussing people out. And when their guys left and Mac left and everything else, I went to bed, and she'd come in during, you know, when we arrived, and was, you know, we weren't noisy or anything, but I put on some music, and she came downstairs, and I thought it was, you know, so it wasn't loud. I had a young daughter, so I didn't want to kind of wake her up or whatever, you know. So Robbie came down, she was in and out for, you know, I introduced the guys to her, and she was hanging, she'd not a hang around her, you know, she was like, oh, okay, you know, you're back home, and these are the guys, and whatever. And, so she was in and out. I don't think she made us any tea or anything like that, because we were into drinking pop, in so much as I had some wine or whiskey or something there, you know, and that's what we were into. Probably some of my moonshine. But the thing is, she got us on talking to them. She was there for a little bit, because it interests, you know. Anyway, when I went to bed, I went, what do you reckon to the, you know, she knew Mac, so it was, what do you reckon to them guys? She said, well, they're definitely not who they're making out to be. That was a straight
so off. Let me just ask you this then, because everybody involved that you talk to that aren't cops, everybody involved in that story about Operation Julie,
mm-hmm.
says they knew very early on that these undercover cops were cops.
Yeah.
So why...
Same too. Yeah.
What's... I mean, why did they not sort of jump ship?
I really don't know.
I mean, I would have run a mile.
Yeah, well, it's a really good question, Tom, because it's a really good question. And I don't really know how to answer that one, because really, I don't know how to answer that one.
I mean, you did get out before the...
Oh, yeah.
So you had a bit of an...
Well, the thing is, between that introduction to them, you're not asking me, and I don't know if I should sort of say it, but maybe I will say certain things. And that is, I do know people, and I've got contacts, and I had contacts back then, and I did my own kind of checking on these guys. So I could ring somebody and say... Now, a lot of people at the end of this book and everything else, they don't know who I am and what I did and what I didn't do and all the rest of it. I was not a cop. I was not anything to do with any of the agencies or whatever that people, you know, thought I may be on the side of the law. It was the opposite. So I just want to get the record.
Yeah. But at the same time, you weren't part of the acid production or distribution network. Is that correct? Because when you got busted, they didn't find anything, did they?
No. You're jumping to two questions there, which is fine. I knew people involved with both setups.
Right.
After, you know, because, and some of these people are dead now, but one of them was Brian.
Oh, right, yeah, okay.
Okay, so I get there. So Brian, bless him, I hope Roma, if she gets to hear this, I don't know, just kind of, you know, what it is, but Roma was very different, but Brian was linked with Smiles' setup in a way, in so much as he would, he was a doper, and he, whatever he did was muling or basically would get from Smiles and distribute and or buy from Smiles and sell on, whatever, all that kind of stuff. So he was that. So I knew Brian straight away as, well, he is what he is doing, what he's doing. I was not interested, but I know what's going on.
Okay.
Through him, and then meeting other people very, very shortly, like Mac and whatever.
Okay. So at most, what you did was you knew stuff was going on, but you never told anybody.
No. I mean, and as you know, it's come to light, which is, you know, two operations going on, you know, Smiles and involved with the London operation, and just down the road, you know, as this musical has pointed out, which is quite funny, you know, how they've portrayed it. But basically, some people knew that both operations was happening very close to one another, or interlinked with selling acid, or manufacturing and distribution of acid and other stuff. With Smiles, he was doing whatever he, you know, it's not a, it wasn't, it was common knowledge that basically, you know, if you wanted some stuff from, he was a dealer, put it on
there.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So in the musical, which the more I think about it, the more I like it actually, it was done so nicely. and the central characters in the musical, really, well, I suppose there were three, really. There were the Richard Kemp and his girlfriend, Christine Bott.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the other main character, well, there was the police.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other main character really was Smiles. And but the movie, the kind of theme that ran through the musical was the relationship between Richard and Christine and the effect that their enterprise had on them, and in fact in the end put them both in jail. Richard was an
amazing chemist
who produced really good acid, and he was on a mission to make the world a better place. And Christine was in love with him, and she totally supported him. And Smiles wasn't connected to them, was he?
No, really, he wasn't.
Was getting his acid from
London,
from the London operation, which was not connected to Richard. So it was a really complicated. But and then of course in the end it all came unstuck because of Operation Julie, where these undercover cops put it all together what was happening, and then there was this massive bust, which you also got caught up in. By this time, you'd moved out of Landry Brevi to a house 2 or 3 miles away at Cillian, and in the middle of the night. Well, tell me about it, John.
What, the morning of the bust? Okay, yeah, well, so the night before, a friend of mine popped around. I mean, I'd cleaned my place up, put it this way, because of something that happened with Steve and Buzz coming to my place, and I thought, okay, now's the time to just really make a distance from these guys. It's more than obvious. I mean, by that time, 2 months before, I think roughly month and a half, I went, okay, time to clean up and clear out and get distance myself from this movie, because people are going to go down and I ain't going down with them. Also, there's a lot more that I know, so there's a lot more that I could get caught up in, and that would affect me, my family, and my situation. And so conspiracy is knowing what's going on and knowing people and not knowing what they have on me, meaning the law, was like too messy to be, just get distance yourself from everything and get the out quick and do it fairly discreetly. So that was it. So the night before the bust, a friend of mine from California, and he came round and he found, he knew I was leaving pretty shortly. Well, it wasn't for a couple of weeks, because I'd already got my tickets out. Robbie was going to go back to Leicester and I was going to leave the country. She didn't want to come with me because I was going to leave on my own and she was going back home type thing. So he knew I was leaving and he just popped round and, seen for a while, but he knew, he just came round for it. And he brought his own grown stuff, whatever. He brought what he did. And we had a toke, blah, blah, blah. So that was it. And he left. I goes to bed at, I don't know, whenever he left, probably 1 a.m. or whatever, I don't know what time it was, but anyway, Robbie had been fast asleep upstairs, just Rupert and myself, around the fire. And I went back. Now, Robbie and I was in bed and in one room, and our daughter had her own small room, so she was at an age where she slept on her own, and we blah blah blah. So come 5 o'clock in the morning, which it seems like everybody got busted at 5 o'clock in the morning from accounts, crash bang wallop. Now my door was now not locked. It was, you lift the latch and you walk in. So they could have just done that and walked straight in without all this. And one hell of a, where we lived was in silence, in, it was a quiet, peaceful place. So, you don't have any banging going on at all. Well, a hell of a crash. And I jumped out of bed, with bollocky buff, nothing on. Goes down the stairs. Now there's a kind of stairwell halfway down the stairs, but I didn't even get down half the stairs when two kind of guerrillas, cops, with two guns, one out of whatever, big, you know, it's, what can I say? It felt like a sawn-off shotgun type thing. It was a big gun, and the other one, I got one gun shoved in my belly. You know, I'm like, what the fuck? I'm glad that I didn't have a gun or anything, because if I had, I would have definitely probably used it, because it was like somebody crashing. But, you know, so these two guys just completely grabbed me, and I've got, as I say, nothing on. I'm going, what the, you know, I'm not fighting these guys. I'm, you know, there's no way I am. When they got me into the living room, the living room was full of cops, and not just, you know, female cops as well. It was like, I don't know. I worked out afterwards, without exaggerating, there must have been about 15 all told by the time they'd started searching the place and what was outside when I left. There's two vans, and they had dogs, they had, you know, it was pretty heavy duty, you know, for a guy with his lady and a child, you know.
Yeah, what's absolutely amazing is that couldn't pin anything on you.
No.
And you walked away.
Yeah. It. I mean, before we get to that, maybe I should finish this off, because I won't go into the whole story of how they searched the room, but they tried to put handcuffs on my back. The cuffs were too small, and I'm going, hey, well, slow down, guys. So I've still got the scar on my wrist as a reminder of them trying to put on there were smaller handcuffs than my wrists, and I haven't got that big a wrist, but it must have been kids' things, you know. And they couldn't get them on. I know they're struggling to get these handcuffs, and I'm going, fuck me, guys, this is, you know, you don't need, I ain't running. Anyway, the whole process went on, and that's a whole story in itself. Then they take me down, handcuffed, behind my back, into a van. They took Robbie and my daughter in another car van. They had Robbie separate from me, and she told me later what went on with that whole thing. They were searching for needles, they were searching for needle pricks in my daughter, and heavy duty shit, you know, for somebody that's not in. Robbie did not smoke. She wasn't into smoking. She wasn't into taking drugs. She was very innocently not bothered with any of that stuff. She just didn't like it, didn't want it. Get down to the Lampeter prison, or Lampeter station, I should say, and I go in a room. Now, they went through my place like a dose of salts. As I say, my place was clean. The only thing they found was a brooch from the night before of Rupert and myself. He brought some stuff around and we smoked, and they found a brooch out of all the stuff in the place. So what surprised me was this. Somehow, they got my straight passport, which was John Howard Allen. They didn't find any tickets because they weren't there to be found. But I had tickets arranged to get to be gone. They didn't find them because they weren't in the building. So I put them separate, thank goodness. But what was strange for me was when I got down to the Lampeter station, they did some questioning. Now, there was other people that I recognised. I didn't recognise Smiles there. And I didn't see, but I saw a few people that I knew that were taken into different rooms. Now, they questioned me, but they didn't really interrogate. They didn't really question me that much, you know. And by the afternoon sometime, or early evening, surprised me, you know, because I thought, well, you know, what's going down, you know. They gave me my passport back and said, you can go, without a charge. And I'm going, thank you very much, I'm out of here. So I got a taxi back. To be honest, I didn't get a taxi back. I remember, I'm going to walk back home, because I'm going to walk back home. I wanted it back to Cillian, the back route, taking my time, thinking, you know. I said, where's Robbie? And they said, oh, they're back in the house, they're okay. You know, they're back home, with either taken back or whatever. So I wanted to have time to think about what, but I was totally surprised that I'd been let go, you know, without something, after all that, you know what I mean? So I get back home. Robbie's kind of, you know, she's in shock, obviously, of like, what the fuck was that all about, you know? She was surprised to see me. And for me, I'm kind of going, well, all right, I'm out, you know. And it felt really strange because I know, I don't know what the process for the next few days, but it's basically, right, okay, well, let's get Robbie back. Let's get Robbie out of here to Leicester. And that's number one. Now, when she got back to Leicester, unbeknown to me, later, she got a letter saying she had to appear at Swindon Court. Now, I didn't know that until a lot later. I was out of the country by that time. So they couldn't put a Swindon notice on me. And I don't know if they tried or they, you know, I don't know anything about that. All I knew is get the fuck out of here and get distance myself from all of this.
So, you know. So John, that would be the last time you saw the people on that scene.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was 45 years ago. Yeah.
I mean, that was basically March the 26th, I think it is, 1977, when that morning. Okay.
I mean, truth is, from what I'm gathering here, I mean, I know you've got stuff that you keep to yourself, which is fair enough, but what I'm getting here is that, quite rightly, that you've done nothing wrong and they couldn't pin anything on you, so they had to let you go.
Well, how do you define right or wrong? But
right, in their terms, weren't connected to the two.
They couldn't nail me for... They couldn't nail me. Let's leave it at that.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so because one of the things, John, and I don't want to... We haven't got a huge amount of time here, but one of the things that's interesting is because you walked away from that and because your whole role in that Landewberry scene, no one really knew what it was about. Or, and when you read the books, there's rumours about what happened to you afterwards and rumours about what your role was, and none of it, as far as I can gather, is true. No one really seems to know what you're about. Your modus operandi is to keep everybody in that state, really, which is, you know, fine. But it does, when we went up to Aberystwyth and you knew you were probably going to meet people from that time, and I felt slightly apprehensive about it because I kind of felt like some of the people involved weren't clear about what your role was, and they were worried. They would be worried about you as much as you'd be worried about them. Do you understand where I'm going with that?
Yeah, I do. I wasn't worried about them.
Well, you were nervous.
I wasn't nervous. I wouldn't put it down as being nervous. I was apprehensive because, how can I put it? I'm not really nervous. What it was like, they thought I was, they thought I was a cop.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and Smiles thought I was, according to Bentley, I was customs guy, you know, which is like a cop type thing.
Yeah.
The cops didn't know who I was, or the put it this way, Cop Operation Julie didn't know who I was. I didn't know how I would have really put it straight other than to say it as it is. I was never a cop.
Yeah.
And I was, and I don't have to justify that.
No.
It was so fucking ridiculous in my opinion of like,
yeah,
I was the opposite to the cop.
I'm going to say, from my chats to you, clearly some of the stuff that you, well, I don't want to go into it now, but because you haven't told me details, but some of the stuff that you've done in your life is, you know, no cop on earth would ever go near. It's, you know, quite heavy, not heavy duty in terms of violence, but quite heavy duty stuff you've got up to, your adventures you've had in your life. There's no way you're an agent of the law. I'd say, you're completely the opposite. Yeah. Not now. So much, not at that time. In your early life.
Sure.
You were.
And that's what makes it so ridiculous, because, you know, Bentley's got this, gangster. Look. And Smiles thinking, they didn't know who I was.
Well, I think that's, and understandably, that's why they've reached these conclusions.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it is difficult when people are guarding their hand and not, it's difficult. Sure. And that's what makes people jump to these conclusions.
Absolutely. And I understand that, you see, and I understand. But, I'm not telling all, because I've got to cover my butt in this movie as well. It's not like I was totally, So the thing is, there's some truths in what Bentley puts in his book. There's some truths to that.
Yeah.
And it's his story behind that. Yeah. Now, I have my story behind that. But the point is, the some truths is enough to have nailed me.
Yeah.
And that's what I was... I'm not afraid of that, because Billy, who's mentioned in the book with me, I knew in Canada 5 years before, But they had enough. If they'd been tapping... I didn't have a phone, but if they'd been... And you've got two cops that's travelling with me, and I've invited them to that, into that scenario. So there's things in that book that I was, in a way, playing devil's advocate, which was close to the edge, which in on reflection was stupid.
Yeah.
Because it could have very easily been one of them scenarios in my life that took me into a position where I would be definitely, the police would put me away.
Yeah. No, fair enough, John.
Okay.
So let's just move on now to what was, for me, without any doubt, the highlight of the trip, which was the show in Aberystwyth. Yeah. I want to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah.
Now, Steve Bentley, who I spent quite a lot of time talking to, and we actually had a really... we'll lose half my audience here by saying I really enjoyed talking to him. I thought he was a nice guy.
Yeah.
Obviously, he was responsible, or his actions were responsible for causing a lot of havoc in a lot of people's lives unnecessarily. People ending up in jail for committing crimes that shouldn't even be crimes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I acknowledge all that, but it was still a good conversation, and I think he wrote a good book. Now, that book that he wrote was the story that we saw in that musical. Or at least I recognised a lot of the things that happened in the musical from my reading of that book. Now, I have read about four books now on this Operation Julie, so I can't quite totally remember where I'm getting what information from. But nevertheless, there was stuff in that book, like the sheep chewing through the radio cable and stuff like that, that clearly came out of Steve's book. Because he was involved in that. We had this really great performance, which was the musical of Operation Julie, which ended in the arrest of a whole load of people and a whole load of people getting sent to jail for really long jail terms. But a couple of things we want to talk about regards the show. One is it was very emotional at times, and Gaynor, who was the director, put a lot of emphasis on the environmental side of things, because Richard Kemp, when he got arrested, he wrote a 50-page statement to justify what he was doing. And then he was advised by his lawyers not to read it out in court, because it could result in higher sentences for both him and his girlfriend. So he chose not to read it out, but he did pass it on to the Cambrian News, and they published it in full. And it is, I've read some of it, and it's absolutely brilliant. And part of the show was a section of it being read out. I don't know how to... I haven't got time to read it out now, but it is in the programme of the show. It's powerful stuff, and it's turned out, on reflection, to all be true, except I would question the last couple of lines where he kind of indicates that acid would be the solution to, or could be the solution to, mankind's problems, which, you know, I understand where that feeling comes from, and I understand the logic behind that, but I'm not totally convinced that that's the case, you know, that if we put acid in the water supply or something, I genuinely don't think that's going to save the world. I don't know how you feel about that one, John, or whether you think I've described things right about it.
No, I think you've described it well. I mean, I'm in the same mode. I didn't never, you know, from my experience of taking acid myself, which can only go by my own experience, and that was many years before even getting to Wales, and other substances, you know, peyote and so on and so forth. I never saw those as a world changer. So I never saw as acid being the answer, having taken my trips. I took the first one on my own, on a boat, on my own. And from my experience of the strength of, which was, I guess, the, you know, original sort of California sunshine, I don't know, you know, but I know from my experience that I certainly wouldn't say recommend that to every Tom, Dick and Harry, as we find out with the Stones concert, that, you know, some people, you know, people can get killed because they're out of their head, you know, and I wouldn't want to be in situations with the acid that I took without being around a safe environment and good company and so on and so forth, you know, with some support and help. So, yeah, turning on, going into a pub and saying, hey, oh, guys, here you go, it's free, which, you know, happened in California where they dropped, with the Grateful Dead, they dropped from a plane. I don't know if you know about this, Tom, but a festival, they just dropped it from the plane, in from the sky, onto the festival and help yourself. You know,
okay. That was a great, I couldn't agree more with you, John, about the necessity to take care psychedelic drugs or with any drugs, and I'm really glad we got that in, because if there's one thing missing in that question and answers last night, it came across a little bit like a pro-drugs advert, which I don't want to put it down. And to be fair to Andy Roberts, who was on the panel, he did give it a bit of balance. But it wasn't, in my view, it wasn't really quite enough, because I know there are some people who have maybe not come totally unstuck, but have got themselves into some quite difficult situations through using drugs. And I used a lot of drugs myself, and I survived, but there were times and moments where I honestly was thinking, I wish I hadn't done this. This is a bit more than I can handle. And I felt quite often, and I've seen, actually, I had a friend who I could see she was in an awful lot of trouble. And it was one of those situations where you're just thinking, gee, I can't wait for her to come out of this. This is horrible. So I'm not going to ever say, you need to do this, which slightly came across, I thought, last night.
Yeah, I mean, so that my feeling is, I if I had any sort of hesitation or you felt some nervousness for me, Tom, if you want to, I'm telling you what I was nervous about. And I was nervous about knowing who I am and what I am in certain circumstances. I could lose it very, very easily. I've got no problem in opening my mouth and saying what I feel at certain times. So I knew I had to sit on probably something that's touching what you're touching there. It's like, we're not singing from the same fucking page here. You know, if it's an open discussion or as a panel here, there's a few things that need to be put into balance. Yeah, I had some great trips. I had some trips that weren't so great. And I've seen a lot of things around stuff that I would say, thanks, but no thanks. That was me. But other people couldn't say thanks, but no thanks. And went on some bad trips regardless of, so I can't sing from, I didn't sing from the same page as Smiles or Buzz or Kemp and Bot, and, you know, whatever. I had my own trip going on there. And I'm not saying I'm squeaky clean, I'm not. But what I'm saying is I couldn't advocate, you know, save the world by dropping acid, no. And that's, I wanted to say that. So, and I could get up in the stage there, questions and answers, go, bullshit, bullshit. Fucking, you know, put them on the line. And that's what I was a little bit, could I hold that in? Because I know that I can explode.
Yeah, now I'm just going to say, I know when we came out of that show last night and we got in the car and drove home, and you actually said virtually the same thing, that you did feel that you needed to say, or someone needed to say, you know, you need to take care with this.
Yeah.
Now, I don't want to sound like, make us sound like a couple of old fogies, because it is coming across slightly like that. But we are talking from experience here. And,
yeah, and I'm talking from experience from prior to Julie, 5 or 6 years, and prior to my experience of being from 16, mate. So, I've, you know, it's not just, you know, I was 25 then. So I'd been around the block. I'd been to, travelled the West Indies. I'd been around the rich and famous and all that. I've got some experience. The thing was that I lost a lot of friends through them not being able to say no and having too much and of one thing or another. And not just, or different kinds of dope, and going on to heroin and going on to becoming alcoholics or drug addicts and that. I lost friends that, and they lost money, their wives, and they lost their life and their health. So there's that. And I couldn't laugh that off. That was a part of the, I'd been involved with that stuff. I could have gone down there myself.
Yeah, I think let's give credit where it's due here. Andy Roberts, who was on the panel, gave a very, very honest and fair answer to that question. And he did say that, you know, the number of people negatively affected by psychedelic drugs is minimal. He actually said you're more likely to get killed by being run over by your dealer than you are to. I think he had a balance
view. Yeah, he did.
Anyway,
yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So maybe we've laboured this point a little bit too much. Just to say, it was great to talk to you, Blue, John, and great to get your side of the story. And I want to give a big plug to the Operation Julie the musical. If you get the chance to see it, it's showing in Aberystwyth, it's showing in Brecon and in Carmarthen over the next few weeks. It is absolutely brilliant. The music is fantastic, and there's so many laughs, there's almost tears. It's a real class. One more point I've got to just say, Bob Dylan makes an appearance, and as it's rumoured, he also made an appearance in Landry Brevi, and we won't cover that, but it's an interesting point. Maybe we'll get back to it another time, but John assures me that's actually true. He did make
it. It is true. And I'd just like to second what you were saying there, Tom. I thought it was a brilliant movie. I think they did a fantastic job. Great set, great director and everything. I highly recommend it as a musical. And I had a great time. And I really appreciate that I could share that with Tom as well. Thank you.
Excellent job, John. Nice to speak to you, and catch up later.
Yeah.
Take care, mate. Okay, go. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.